the timers aren't working. And so we're going to do it the way that, here we go, we're in a brave new world. Our first case is Greedy versus the Bank of New York. It's 10-3787, 10-3990, and 11-1123. And it's Ms. Stege. Good morning.
Good morning. May it please the court. When Sentinel Management Group ended up in bankruptcy in August of 2007, its lender, Bank of New York, was holding securities as collateral for a loan it had made to Sentinel that should have instead been on deposit in customer-segregated accounts held only for the benefit of Sentinel's customers. Despite the fact that Bank of New York had agreed contractually with Sentinel that it would not look to customer property to secure this loan, and despite the fact that doing so placed Bank of New York and Sentinel in violation of the Commodity Exchange Act and CFTC regulations, Bank of New York refused to return this property when the bankruptcy was filed.
You know, forgive me for just one moment, because I want to clarify something very quickly. Around page 44 of the opening brief, and for several pages thereafter, there's a reference made to Section 4DB. I take it you meant for all of those to be 6DB or not.
Well, there's an anomaly with how one refers to the Commodities Exchange Act. If you're talking about it in the colloquial Commodities Exchange Act, parties refer to it as Section 4DB because of something that had to happen when it was codified. When you use the U.S. Code site, it's Section 6DB. Mm. So they're two off in the lower portions of the Commodities Exchange Act. So you'll see in the CFTC's amicus brief and in our brief, when it's being referred without the 7 U.S. Code, it'll be referred to as 4DB. But that's the same as 6DB.
I may have missed the footnotes. Were there footnotes to that effect?
There were not, Your Honor.
I see. All right.
Well, when Bank of New York refused to return this property that it had received in violation of the Commodities Exchange Act, the trustee sued to unwind the transfers that created this collateral interest for Bank of New York as actual fraudulent transfers or to equitably subordinate the liens that Bank of New York was granted. Contrary to the implication in Bank of New York's brief, the trustee is not seeking a windfall here. All he seeks to do is to put the parties, the creditors, back in the priority that they would have enjoyed vis-a-vis this customer property had these illegal transfers not been made by Sentinel. The court faces two central legal issues by this appeal. The first issue is when Sentinel, in effect, robbed Peter, its customers, to pay Paul, the Bank of New York, in violation of federal law and the parties' contracts. Were those transfers made with an intent to hinder, delay, or defraud creditors?
Well, let me just ask you this. I know you have a second point, but let's go into that a little bit. How could the bank have successfully monitored what Sentinel was doing? I know you suggested in your brief that they could have asked Sentinel's customers whether they'd given Sentinel authority to transfer funds out of segregated accounts for Sentinel's own purposes. But weren't the segregated accounts conglomerations of many customers' funds? Maybe some had given authority, maybe some had not. How was the bank to know what money was at stake in any given, you know, any particular transaction?
Here, the five bulk transfers of securities that were at issue were transfers that were made as a result of direct communications between Sentinel and the Bank of New York. The district court, in its findings that are the numbered findings that appear at the start of its opinion in paragraphs 108 through 157, reference a number of recorded telephone conversations and emails that occurred. And when you look at those underlying exhibits and those communications that the court found occurred, what you will see is what happened with these transfers is Sentinel needed to borrow money at the conclusion of the day in order to make certain payments. It went to the Bank of New York. These loans were extraordinary. Bank of New York asked for, in some of the transfers, information with regard to what was in the segregated accounts. and then made the loan after it assured itself that monies would move out of these segregated accounts over into the collateral account. Under those circumstances, this is not something that just happened in the course of the business day without communication. Communication occurred and review occurred at the highest levels of the people reviewing this. A simple question to Sentinel should have sufficed. The district court found that by June 13th, Bank of New York had suspicions based upon an email that was sent by a senior officer monitoring the Sentinel account, that they had suspicions that the collateral they were receiving was not Sentinel's to pledge. They knew, based on financial statements and information they had received, the district court found that Sentinel had only $3 million of its own capital, yet Sentinel was borrowing $500 million from the bank. They knew, as the district court found, that Sentinel was required to hold customer securities in segregation. They knew that Sentinel was taking customer securities from segregation, as the district court found, and pledging it to secure that loan. Their expert and those officers testified that you can't take funds from segregation to secure the loan that is owed by the Futures Commission merchant, and they knew that those securities were going to secure a loan that was obtained solely for Sentinel's own benefit for proprietary trading that it was doing on its own behalf. Under those circumstances, where the district court found that objectively Bank of New York should have known, it should have done something more than sit back and do nothing. And that's what it did.
What did it do in response to this suspicion?
It did nothing in response to that suspicion except to continue to request from Sentinel that Sentinel transfer customer securities out of the customer segregated accounts and into the collateral account where Bank of New York's lien could be placed. And that is why the district court should have found that there was an actual intent on Sentinel's part to hinder, delay, or defraud creditors.
Well, he found anything but. He found that they were such artless liars on the stand, the employees, that he could only conclude that they weren't concealing deliberate wrongdoing, but rather, were trying to cover up their own incompetence. And, I mean, what conduct here could not be explained by incompetence? In other words, what I'm trying to get to is this: what reason do we have to doubt Judge Zagel's interpretation of the facts?
I think a key reason is the June 13th email. As he finds, that email sent by a senior officer asks and states, "I presume we do not have an interest in the collateral that is being pledged." In response to that email, the party to whom it is sent goes and consults with other senior officers. They realize, I think the only inference that one can draw from what happened, is that they realized that this email might become centerpiece in litigation over who had rights in the customer property. And so there was a carefully worded response after consultation, which is what the district court finds, happened so that there would not be something that would look in that email as if someone acknowledged the suspicion. And as the district...
Is that the one sentence that begins with hello?
Yes, that's correct. And that wording of that email, I think, tells you that Bank of New York and the district court found that as of that date, June 13th, it was not objectively reasonable at that point for the Bank of New York any longer to rely on the representations in the parties' contracts about the ability to pledge the securities. With respect to the fraudulent transfer claims, Bank of New York's intent is not relevant. What is relevant is Sentinel's intent, whether Sentinel made the transfers with an actual intent to hinder, delay, or defraud creditors. And the law in this circuit and elsewhere is that if you make a transfer illegally, if you make a transfer in violation of a law designed to protect a particular creditor group, if you rob one party to pay the other, that is a transfer, the necessary consequence of which is to hinder, delay, or defraud the creditors whose property is taken.
Are you saying as long as Sentinel knew, Bank of New York didn't need to know?
with respect to the elements of the trustee's prima facie case for a fraudulent transfer claim under 548A1 in Section 5 of the Illinois Uniform Transfer Code, that is correct. It is Sentinel's intent, not the transferee's intent, that matters. And Sentinel's intent, Sentinel knew that was customer property, and Sentinel knew it was taking customer property in violation of the statute and transferring it to Bank of New York. That is the intent that matters. Now, Bank of New York has a defense, the good faith defense for value under Section 548C. The district court never addressed that. That would have to be remanded. We would submit under the standards that this court has established in Scholes v. Lehman, and that is the standard that the other courts of appeals that have addressed the issue have set. By finding they objectively knew or should have known that the property was customer property, they can't make out that defense. But that wasn't addressed.
Okay. So if we find, as the CFTC has urged, that Sentinel's customer accounts were subject to 60B and that the bank violated that section, would we have to remand? You said the word remand.
I think with regard to...
And it just...
Both of the claims. I think what the court would do with the fraudulent transfer claim is to find that the transfers were made with an actual intent to hinder, delay, and defraud creditors due to the legal errors of the court, and would need to remand for consideration of the affirmative defense and the amount that would be avoided. With respect to the equitable subordination claim, mm-hmm. if you find that Bank of New York had a legal duty under Section 4DB, and you find that the standard is objective, as it is under this court's case law, such as Lifschultz Fast Freight, then Your Honor would need to remand solely for purposes of determining the extent of the equitable subordination. Judge Zagel, in his opinion, writes about what he thinks the range of that might be, but he doesn't finally conclude what the amount of the equitable subordination should
be. Yeah, but I certainly get the impression from his opinion that this one change would absolutely not change the outcome, at least not the outcome, you know, of the equitable subordination claim.
You're making the distinction on objective and subjective.
Yes.
And you're saying Judge Zagel used subjective, and you say that the objective.
Yes, I do. With regard to the equitable subordination claim, when judging whether or not Bank of New York breached its legal duty under 4DB not to take a lien on the customer properties, the standard should be objective. It should be objective because the seminal case in the area of equitable subordination, the Fifth Circuit's case in Mobile Steel, which this court has adopted and cited with approval in its numerous equitable subordination cases, applies an objective standard. Applying an objective standard is consistent with what that legal duty is. Under Section 4DB of the Commodity Exchange Act, there is no requirement of willfulness or scienter on the part of the bank to violate that provision. The CFTC lays out the reasons why in their amicus brief, and the statute on its face does not require that the bank act in a willful or subjectively intentive way if in violating that statute. So the legal duty that's breached doesn't require a subjective intent.
Yeah, but look, there's this huge dispute as to whether Sentinel was a futures commission merchant or an FCM, as you say. But never in front of Judge Easterbrook. He doesn't like letters. Everyone agrees that Sentinel's customers were FCMs.
Correct, John.
Okay. Sentinel couldn't accept funds for investment from the client FCMs unless Sentinel registered as an FCM.
That's correct, John.
Sentinel then acted as an agent for its customer FCMs in making deposits at the bank with the customer's funds. And that's why the CFTC argues that it was an FCM.
That's correct. And I think you could view Sentinel as an FCM, or you could view it as a depository. It was receiving deposits from FCMs and then further depositing them with Bank of New York. If you look at the language of Section 4DB, it does not require that the depository be an FCM. Bank of New York is a depository. The district court found that it was. It received customer properties from FCMs. Either Sentinel was an FCM in the middle, as the CFTC argues, as it registered, as all parties have accepted, including Bank of New York, when it agreed to comply as a depository of an FCM Sentinel, or you view Sentinel as an agent for these FCMs, itself a depository. In either case,
Would you agree that Sentinel was not engaged in soliciting or accepting futures contracts?
That is true. Sentinel did not.
What about that language of, what is it, 7 U.S.C. section 1A20?
Well,
does that define what an FCM is?
That is a definition of an FCM. However, the business that Sentinel was in was basically taking the customer funds, in-house funds of FCMs, money that they held on their own, but basically customer funds, and the FCMs were entitled to treat it when it was on deposit with Sentinel as if it was on deposit in their own segregated accounts. And so the CFTC required Sentinel to be registered as an FCM, governed by the FCM regulations. Bank of New York agreed when it got this business and it made substantial money on this business over the life of the time that it had it, that it would treat Sentinel as an FCM and it too would be bound by the Commodity Exchange Act and CFTC regulations. And I think that you can get to the same result by viewing Sentinel as a depository and it having obligations under Section 4DB of the Commodity Exchange Act. Either way you look at it, they had an obligation to keep these funds segregated, and when they transferred the funds out of segregation, they violated the law.
Your papers argue vigorously that you were entitled to a presumption of fraud. Mm-hmm. Do you win even if you don't get that presumption?
Yes, we do, because stealing money, taking, this is a crime to take funds out of segregated accounts. It is wrongful. Civil enforcement actions are pending against Sentinel. Its principals have all pled the Fifth Amendment when asked questions about this. It's a crime. The natural effect of that crime is to take...
What U.S. attorney is going to bring this indictment?
They've brought other indictments against other commodities firms that have done the same thing. There are civil enforcement actions pending. Fifth Amendment has been taken. There was massive under segregation here.
But crime or theft alone isn't enough, is it? It has to be fraudulent.
Theft is one of the things that the district court judge did wrong was confuse motivations with the natural consequences. In Shapiro v. Wilgus, a Supreme Court decision from the 30s, one of the seminal cases in the area, the court found that the transfer acted with good faith and in the belief that what he did was lawful. But if the natural effect is to prevent one creditor from having access to property that it should have had in favor of another creditor who received that property, that natural effect is an intent to hinder, delay, or defraud creditors. You just have to defraud any creditor, not all creditors. Here, Sentinel's conduct defrauded its customer creditors. And I see that I'm using up my...
How do you see it?
Because she's...
I know, but wow. That was...
I just...
Okay.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors.
You know, is there a place that you could sit, like, in front of them? I mean... Yeah, because, you know, they have to keep, like doing what I'm doing, staring at you every 2 minutes. Okay, that, go ahead.
Good morning. May it please the court. Judge Zagel sifted through an enormous amount of evidence, and he found that there was insufficient proof of actual intent to defraud the creditor body as opposed to perhaps preferring the bank or the repo creditors with respect to those 5 transfers. And he found that there was no knowledge or willful indifference on the part of the bank or its employees with respect to any wrongdoing at Sentinel.
Now, you know, that's so interesting because, to be honest with you, I've never really seen badly executed lying weighing in a party's favor.
Well, Your Honor, he did. There were inconsistent statements, but Judge Zagel didn't find them to be about anything material, like knowledge of wrongdoing at Sentinel. There were inconsistent statements about memories, about emails and conversations years ago. And here's what Judge Zagel concluded about that. He said that even my criticism of the bank and its employees is based not on what the bank should have done, but what it could have done. And he properly found that a could-have-done or could-have-known standard is way insufficient for the radical remedy of equitable subordination. And then he found the same thing for should-have-done, because there has to be some sort of state-of-mind requirement for equitable subordination. But nevertheless, he applied the should-have-done standard, and he found that the bank would not be liable on it, under it, because it had no legal obligation to monitor Sentinel segregation compliance, and because it would have been virtually impossible for it to do so. Now, I'd like to I want to raise some of the misconceptions that I think characterize the legal analysis of my colleague. The first is that there's something inherently wrong or suspect about a lot of transfers out of segregated accounts. That's not true at all. These are routine and authorized by the statute. The CFTC has said they should be frequent, and the statute says that segregated customer funds, this is in 68.2, quote, may be withdrawn. So that's an affirmative authorization that lists a variety of legitimate purposes. The regulations make clear there's only two limits on the right to make these transfers. One, they can't be for an illegitimate purpose. And two, they can't leave the FCM under-segregated. In other words, it has to have enough assets in its segregated accounts to meet the liabilities to its customers. Now, the statute does not put any duty on depository banks to monitor purpose or segregation compliance. There's not a word of it. And, in fact, the reporting and record-keeping requirements in the regulations are all put on the FCM, not on the bank. And there's good reason for this, because the banks are... And you can't hold up the execution of these thousands of transfer requests that are coming in every day based on an investigation into their purpose. And the bank is in no position to know an FCM's segregation status at any particular moment in time.
Why were the phone calls between Sentinel and the bank recorded? I assume it was the bank doing the recording, right?
No, it was not. In fact, the bank employees didn't know they were being recorded. These were, I believe, discovered in the course of Mr. Greed's investigation afterwards.
Who was recording?
Yeah, it was Sentinel that was doing the recording.
Just routine?
Yeah.
It was routine, and you know, there's Judge Zagel listened to dozens of hours of these phone conversations, and he didn't find a word indicating that any bank employee had any knowledge or even suspicion on any of those phone calls of any wrongdoing on Sentinel.
So,
and again,
Sentinel is, are we absolutely certain of that? Where in the record will we find that it was Sentinel that was doing the recordings?
No, I'm going to have to send that in to you, but we'll look that up. Getting back to the question of how the bank would know Sentinel's segregation status, you know, it would have to know how much was on deposit at the bank from Sentinel's FCM customers as opposed to its non-FCM customers, hedge funds and so forth, who were not subject to the segregation requirements. It would have to know the market value of the securities in segregation at the bank at any point in time, which was always fluctuating, and it would also have to know the value of the cash and securities on deposit in associated segregated accounts at other financial institutions like J.P. Morgan Chase. The bank never had that information. Now, Sentinel did prepare a daily segregation status report, but that was not given to the bank. It was given to the NFA and the CFTC. So you know, and there's this sort of statutory division of responsibility here. The bank's supposed to set up the segregated accounts and make sure that it keeps its hands off of anything in the segregated accounts. And it's up to the FCM, insofar as this applies to Sentinel, in this case the Sentinel, to make representations and warranties and to make sure that it complies with its segregation responsibilities under the oversight of the regulatory agencies.
Well, but it seems that Sentinel couldn't have taken on this business without being registered as an FCM, and it also seems that Sentinel was acting as an agent for its customer FCMs. And so if you're a registered FCM acting as an agent for other FCMs, how can you not be an FCM? I mean, didn't Sentinel stand in the shoes?
No, we argue that it's not. Everybody agrees that it.
Let me finish.
I'm sorry.
Didn't Sentinel stand in the shoes of its customer FCMs?
Well, I wouldn't say it stood in the shoes, but
stood in the socks? What?
No, it was essentially their money manager or investment manager, and it certainly registered it as an FCM. And Judge Zagel disagreed with us that this segregation regime doesn't apply here, but he properly found that even if you assume that it applies, that there was no violation. And I want to point out that Sentinel and the bank entered into a segregation letter in 2003 that reflects the the sort of statutory division of responsibility. It says that Sentinel is responsible for complying with the CEA and its regulations, quote, without any obligation by the bank to inquire into the FCM's compliance with such provisions and regulations. That's BTX 72. And this is a letter that was reviewed and accepted by the regulatory agencies. Now, a third misconception is that there's something wrong about pledging customer securities for the bank loan or for the repo loans. Now, Mr. Greed says that Sentinel had only $2 to $3 million of its own capital, so therefore the bank had to know that all this collateral coming in was securities that were required to be segregated. And that's not true. It improperly assumes that there's only two buckets of deployable assets. First of all, 35% of Sentinel's customers were not FCMs, and so were not subject to the segregation requirements. But even for those who were FCMs, you know, a security could be required to be segregated at 2 o'clock, and at 2:15, it's not required to be segregated. And let me give an example. Suppose a client, one of Sentinel's clients, wires in and says, I want to redeem $5 million. And this happened many times every day because these were brokerages and hedge funds that had to make margin payments and so on. So if they redeem $5 million, Sentinel at that point has $5 million less in segregation liabilities. So what it could do is take a $5 million security out of segregation and sell it and give the money to the client. But it never did that because if it did, it would lose a lot of interest. Its whole business model was based on holding these long-term securities to maturity. So instead, it would borrow $5 million from the bank, give the bank the security as collateral, and pay that $5 million to the customer. So that would mean the security would get moved out of a segregated account into a lienable account. And that was perfectly legitimate because at that point in time, Sentinel had $5 million less in segregation responsibilities. And if you multiply that example by the tens of thousands of transactions here, and also the fact that Sentinel's customers didn't own particular securities, but only interests in a pool of securities, Judge Zagel was right to say that it would be impossible for the bank to trace the source of the collateral that was being used in return for its loans. You know, I want to, Your Honor, point out a particular document exhibit here to the panel because I don't want it to get lost in the shuffle. And this reflects the extent to which the agencies and also the auditors and the customers all knew about the pledging of customer securities for the bank loan and the repos and were perfectly fine with it. The particular exhibit is BTX 35, and it's a letter that was written from Sentinel's auditor to the CFTC in 2002. And you know, it summarizes conversations that the auditor had been having with CFTC staff. And here's what the letter says. Quote, Sentinel will...
Say it again, the last sentence, I missed a word.
I'm sorry. It's a letter from
Sentinel's
auditor to the CFTC that summarizes conversations he had been having with the CFTC staff. And the letter says, quote, Sentinel will pledge particular customer-owned securities to collateralize the bank loan. Exactly what Mr. Greed says is improper and deceptive. Also says the bank loan is not specifically identified on the customer statements.
What does the word particularized mean?
No, particular, I'm sorry, particular customer-owned securities to collateralize the loan. If you look at the last page of this exhibit, it's an email back from a man who was then the deputy director and chief accountant of the Division of Trading and Markets at the CFTC. And he says, I might characterize some of what you say a little differently, but it doesn't matter. I'm perfectly fine with it. And the record is full of documents that show that the CFTC and NFA understood and accepted the use of customer securities to collateralize these loans. I refer you to the NFA audit memo, BTX 531, which actually diagrams the movement of securities in and out in between the segregated and lienable accounts.
Okay. If we find, as the CFTC urges, that Sentinel customer accounts were subject to Section 60B and that the bank violated that section, would we have to remand? Or can you make an argument that Judge Sagel's judgment could still stand in its entirety? In other words, if he had found that the bank violated 60B, a violation that he likely would have found occurred with no fraudulent intent, you know, from what we see in the opinion, would that have changed his view of the subordination claim?
Well, no, I don't think so. I mean, first of all, he did find there was no violation because the bank was not responsible for monitoring segregation, and it was impossible for the bank to monitor segregation, and that simply using customer securities as collateral is nothing doesn't violate the statute because there's the statute only would bar that if it in fact made Sentinel under-segregated. In answer to your question, it would not require a remand because if they violated the statute in that way, in a way that had never been interpreted before, and where the regulations nowhere say that the bank is responsible for monitoring segregation requirements, how could that rise to the level of, you know, inequity and moral turpitude and the kind of language, conscience-shocking conduct that's required for equitable subordination? And as far as the fraudulent transfer claim, you know, that the courts draw a sharp distinction between transfers that harm the creditor body as a whole, which can be fraudulent transfers, and those that prefer certain creditors over others. And based on all of Judge Zagel's findings, at most you could say that this was a preference if it met the preference requirements, and that claim is not before you. But he found that there was no proof of actual fraudulent intent. Mr. Green never put on any proof with regard to the badges of fraud, which are used for circumstantial evidence. And so there's really no case there for the fraudulent transfer claim, and there's no evidence showing any knowledge or willfulness, which all the cases have required.
But
for
it's,
equitable
and it's the knowledge or willfulness of Sentinel, though, isn't it?
That's only for the fraudulent transfer claim.
Right.
And there's no evidence that they made those five transfers in order to harm the creditor body as opposed to trying to save its business at a time when the credit crunch was leading to these repo counterparties to demand.
But the business it was saving was its proprietary trading, not the role it was playing as the depository for these FCMs.
Oh, no. Judge Zagel said it was trying to save its business as a whole, which would have been, it would have fallen apart if they couldn't meet the demands of those repo counterparties at that time. So it extended its loans from the bank, made the transfers in order to get the loans from the bank to pay the repo counterparties, which returned securities that were used for the benefit of all its customers, not only the small part of the trading that was being done for its proprietary account. You know, all the customers...
Small part. It was pretty sizable, wasn't it?
I'm sorry?
Hundreds of millions of dollars of proprietary trading, wasn't it?
Well, in terms of the total amount that was at stake here, which was well over $1 billion, most of it was being done on behalf of its customers, and most of the customers benefited for many years from this leveraged trading model. They received above-market returns, and they all knew that their customer securities were being used as collateral. You know, if there are – the bank sent out materials to prospective clients that said, quote, "Your investments will be financed by loans from Bank of New York, for which we pledge securities to Bank of New York." If you look at the audited financial statements, notes 2 and 3, which are pages 40 and 41 of Mr. Greed's separate appendix, you'll see they expressly state that customer securities are being pledged to collateralize both the bank loan and the repurchase loans. So the world knew about this. They were perfectly happy about it. The agencies didn't see any problem with it until Sentinel went belly up. And then everyone wants to play the hindsight blame game and point their fingers at what was then the only remaining secured creditor and deep pocket. And that's unfair because in every bankruptcy, the unsecured creditors come out worse than the secured creditors. And it would be inequitable in this situation to subordinate the claim of the bank below brokerages and hedge funds who willingly engaged in a leveraged trading investment strategy in order to seek above-market returns and profited by it for many years until eventually the credit crunch put an end to it.
curious, what is the status of the SEC and CDFC actions against Sentinel and its principals? You know, the cases you mentioned on page 15 of your reply brief is there any is there any reason to believe that the outcomes there will have any effect at all on our case?
No, I don't think so. I believe the cases against Sentinel were settled. The cases against the principals, there's pending motions for summary judgment that are going on. The reason I don't think it will make any difference is that essentially what they were being charged with was kind of a skimming operation where funds and interest were being over-allocated to their proprietary accounts as opposed to customer accounts. And Mr. Greed testifies on page 1773 of the transcript that they essentially skimmed about $28 million. Well, that $28 million is not what brought Sentinel down. It may have left $28 million less for the unsecured creditors. But there's no evidence that the bank or the agencies or anybody else knew what these insiders were doing behind closed doors at Sentinel. None of that came out until Mr. Greed did his very extensive investigation, where he was able to go into Sentinel's computers with the help of Navigant and Macquarie and so forth. At most, Judge Zagel said that one bank employee might have suspected some question about whether the collateral being pledged belonged to others. But he also said this was subject to competing inferences because who these others are, they could be the non-FCM clients, or they could be securities that were legitimately taken out of segregation. But even if you say that he had a reason to be suspect at that time, that doesn't rise to the level of iniquity that's required for equitable subordination.
You know, it seems a little disingenuous for the bank to suggest that the trustee should have put Sentinel's employees on the stand. They wouldn't they have all pled the Fifth?
Some did, Your Honor, but in fact, several a number of Sentinel employees were deposed, some on more than one occasion, and Mr. Greed's attorneys decided not to put them on the stand at trial. So he had full opportunity to try to prove his case about actual fraudulent intent on the part of Sentinel and was not able to do so. If there are no more questions, I'll just conclude by saying that Judge Zagel applied very...
timing's amazing.
Judge Zagel applied established legal principles to factual findings and credibility determinations that Mr. Greed and his counsel have not shown to be clearly erroneous, and for that reason, the judgment below should be affirmed.
Thank you. So now, how many minutes does Ms. Dickey have?
She has 3 minutes.
3 minutes.
First, with respect to the fraudulent transfer claims, it's Sentinel's intent that matters. The district court found Sentinel's property was transferred from customer-segregated accounts. That was in violation of federal law and the contracts. That's a transfer made with an intent to hinder, delay, or defraud creditors. Whether Sentinel had good or bad motives, and I would submit the fact that the principals took $28 million inappropriately out of Sentinel as a result of this fraudulent leverage trading, would suggest their motives were not pure. That motivation does not matter. Judge Zagel erred when he said it did. He erred when he said it was only a preference. Dean v. Davis, a seminal Supreme Court case with regard to fraudulent transfer law, says that preferences can be fraudulent transfers when they're done here, where the effect is to hinder, delay, or defraud any creditor. There is no requirement of harm to all creditors, but here, 90%, 99-plus percent of the creditors, save Bank of New York, were customer creditors whose property was wrongfully taken. There was a fraudulent transfer here, and the judge made a legal error in doing so. With regard to the equitable subordination claim, the district court erred when it held that Bank of New York had no legal duty under 4DB. 4DB required Bank of New York not to take a lien on customer property. It was not limited solely to when that property was in an account. It was when that property was customer property, they could not take a lien on it. The district court found, I would submit, that Bank of New York, if one looks carefully at Judge Zagel's opinion, it is Bank of New York that is contesting the facts here. Judge Zagel found at page 37 and 38 of his opinion that Bank of New York knew Sentinel was required to segregate funds.
But has any court ever held that a bank is subject to 6DB or 4DB or in these circumstances?
It is a question of first impression as to the reading of 4DB, but I would submit that Judge Zagel's statement that because there's no authority, he can't find their libel is incorrect. One looks at the statutory language.
But it certainly suggests that the bank had no idea that it had this obligation that you seem to think it has.
I would disagree, Your Honor. The district court found that by executing the segregation letters, trustees exhibits 11, 12, and 13, that the bank agreed it would be bound by these provisions. These are standard, the most important provisions.
But there's no scienter requirement, and thus no purposefully wrong conduct.
It
has to be shown, and none was shown.
Your Honor, I would disagree. The court found that objectively, Bank of New York knew or should have known it was receiving customer funds in violation of the segregation requirements. The court found only by attributing this argument that their lies showed that they didn't realize it, which we find amazing since they lied about basic important things, such as whether segregation was required in light of the segregation letters. One needs to know and look at the specific facts here. The bank wants to hide behind a parade of horribles, but the fact of the matter is that bank officers were meeting daily about this account. They were asking for lists of collateral in the segregated accounts. And when one looks at the exhibits and the communications that the judge found, one sees that this isn't something that happened to the bank when it wasn't looking. It was actively looking at this and making certain that its lien was protected by taking the best of the customer collateral and moving it over for its benefit. I think I'm done unless the court has any further questions.
Well, when the right construction paper comes up. Thank you. Thank you, everyone. Thank you. Case will be taken under advisement. And the entire courtroom is leaving. I know. Incredible. Wow. Too much interest in this case. We'll wait till everyone has left. Those of you who love an audience when you argue are in bad luck. You both were here, weren't you, when I explained that we have a new system in the Seventh Circuit? All right. Case.